Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital. Very excited about my guest, Sharna Goldseeker. She is a speaker, writer, and consultant who engages multiple generations in the intersection of values and strategies to transform the ways in which they give. And we'll expand on that, I'm sure. She is today's leading expert on multi-generational and next-generation philanthropy. So fascinating to get to know you and your own story. And also, one of the questions I want to understand is the research and findings that you've done. How does that expand this idea of philanthropy and this idea of impact investing? So thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
It's always important is to start out and just to get to know you better. Why don't you give us a little background on yourself, where you grew up, you know, went to school, and a little bit about what you're doing today.
I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. If you've ever taken the Amtrak train down the Northeast Corridor, you have probably slowed down around Baltimore and looked out and seen the row houses, which is our architectural archetype here. We're known for our row houses. And in fact, my great uncle was in the row house business. And
really?
My father worked for him for 18 years. It is he whose estate was left to a charitable foundation the year before I was born. And so that is really the genesis of family philanthropy in our family. And I grew up watching as my father discovered what it meant to steward a charitable foundation. I feel honored to carry out that legacy as well. But I left town to go to University of Pennsylvania for college. I have a bachelor's in urban studies and religious studies and came back to build affordable housing in Baltimore for a couple of years before moving to New York City to attend graduate school and have a master's in nonprofit management from NYU.
So you obviously have some smarts to do what you've been doing.
Kind of
you. Nothing you need to say there other than...
I at least have some degrees, right?
Yeah. So what was it like growing up with this money or capital? When did you know that it was there and how did that affect your upbringing?
I appreciate the question. I mean, on some level, I didn't see myself as someone who had money. As a child, you know, you're always wondering when you're going to get your allowance to purchase your bubble gum or whatever it was at the time you wanted. And on the other hand, I also knew on some level, as I think most children do, that we lived in a nice house and I was able to go to private school. My parents didn't throw excessive stuff, like they weren't material in that way. I also wasn't naive. You know, I could see that not everyone in the world lived the way we did. Perhaps I was also because I'm an only child. And so my parents would bring me a lot of places and I had exposure to things that I think at a young age that not everyone does. And at about 14, I was asked for a grant for the first time. And I remember looking around thinking, are you looking for my mother, my father? I don't even know what it means to make a grant. And so we began this family conversation about what it meant to have a legacy of family philanthropy. And I think because I knew I didn't earn the wealth, my father didn't even earn the wealth that was in the family foundation, right? It's a public charity that was left by my great uncle. We were the stewards of it, that I wanted to earn the right to the legacy and to see it as an opportunity that I could help steward that capital to then allocate for change, for much needed change for people in need.
There's two things that come to mind. One, I'd love to know a little bit more about what you're doing today. And then I want to ask you a question. So if I'm a listener and I hear your just initial story, some could kind of go, well, I'm probably not going to relate because I don't have a bunch of money. I didn't grow up with a bunch of money. Any thoughts for that listener?
I really don't think that it has to be as grand as a private foundation, right? I mean, I started to learn about giving. I recall I was maybe 9 or 10 and I was sitting at home. Didn't it used to be Labor Day weekend when the Jerry Lewis telethon for muscular dystrophy aired? And I was, you know, probably bouncing off the sofa, causing my parents distress. And my father said something to the effect of, do you want to make a contribution? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you have some allowance. And if you give a little bit of your allowance, I will match you. And I remember at the time, after I stopped bouncing on the sofa, thinking, oh, this is interesting, right? And, you know, not long after that, my parents sent away for this banking, children's banking game, where essentially they got like a set of paper checks. And so if I wanted to write a check for something, I would make out a check. Mm-hmm. Really, my parents held on to my allowance, right? And they would, I'm sure, send a real check for the donation. But we would keep a log of my deposits and my checks. And they were just very intentional about educating me about how to be financially aware and to not take for granted that it would be taken care of for me. You know, we weren't talking about millions of dollars in the foundation endowment. I didn't learn about that till maybe I was 29. I was actually became a member of the board of directors, and the curtain was pulled back a little more, you know, distinctly. But I think I encourage parents to start having age-appropriate conversations with young people, whether they see themselves as having wealth or not. We all have to learn the skills to earn our own resources, budget those, and take care of ourselves and hopefully give to others with a little bit of what we have.
So give us a little bit of background then on what you do today.
Along the way, along this journey of me realizing one day I would have this imminent responsibility of stewarding a foundation and really just wanting to be more knowledgeable about how to give resources effectively, I went on my own educational exploration. You know, so I had a lot of internships at nonprofits. I have undergraduate and graduate degrees in the field, if you will. I started writing small checks to figure out what it looked like to interact with organizations who responded to me. If I gave $100, did I need to give more to get response? Did they have information on their website that I could learn about? Could I do a site visit? So forth and so on. Along the way, I met a lot of other young people who are in similar situations of having resources to give. And as my colleague Kristen Kepler likes to say, some felt paralyzed by predecessor. Like if my parents or grandparents were so accomplished that they left a foundation or were big community leaders, how could I live up to that?
Interesting.
Or some felt paralyzed by privilege. How come I have so much and others don't? Or paralyzed by possibility. There are 10 million nonprofits across the globe and 1.5 million in the United States. So even if we are ready for this, how do we even decide and not feel paralyzed by the choices we have to make? And so the work that I have been doing, to answer your question, for the last 20 years is really helping people not be paralyzed, is to say, okay, you have the resources. Let me help you find your purpose. Let me help you find your philanthropic identity and direction. I help people think about what are your values and how do you prioritize those and what informs your decisions? What are the questions you're asking about the world? Where might you want to make a difference? And how do you allocate your resources to match? You know, so you're just doing it thoughtfully and intentionally, but helping people have a roadmap.
So a number of the people who are listening to our show are more on the financial side, and they would ultimately help clients as well think about charity, probably not as in depth as you are. What would you say to that group to learn about the next gen and how they think about capital generally?
Maybe I'll say a couple of things. You know, we know from a lot of research, let's say that U.S. Trust has done research about wealth over the years, that more people than they expect care about their legacy more than their financial legacy. We used to believe as advisors, financial advisors, we just had to help show returns. We needed to make sure, you know, tax incentives were taken care of, and didn't really appreciate that our clients cared about their own personal impact in the world and how their next generation would think about their legacy and be engaged in it. And so I think we've had a bit of a sea change in the last 10 years where there's more dawning awareness to that end. Another piece of research, I believe it came out of PNC Bank, said that after the first parent passes away, only 45% of the kids stay with their parents' advisor. And after the second parent passes, only 2%.
Wow.
Even if we think we only need to deal with the parents' legacy at the time, as advisors, if we want our client families to stay with our firms, we actually do need to connect with the next generation. We can't wait. Even if it's just for pure business motivation, we need to say to our clients, hey, maybe you want to bring your kids around and just introduce them to me. Maybe we want to just explain to them who I am and what my email address is if they need something. Sometimes we host what we would call coffee and donuts with advisors to even teach 20 and 30 somethings the questions they could ask their advisors. Like, to know how to choose them and what they could do for them, how they can serve them. I think because next gen are often very horizontally oriented to their peer group. I mean, think about it. If they want a review of a product, they go on Amazon and mm-hmm. click on write reviews. And if they want a review of a restaurant, they go to Yelp. Like they're used to looking horizontally at their social media, et cetera, their friend networks for advice. They're not always used to vertical advisor input. And so I think we need to begin to build those relationships sooner than we used to think with this next generation, because they don't assume that they will come to advisors like their parents and grandparents have.
So if you were in a room with advisors, given your knowledge and your experience with next gen, we all know the stats on all this capital that's going to transition to the next generation. What are some of the myths that you think advisors might have towards the next generation and how to connect with them?
That's a great question. What are the myths that advisors might have about the next generation?
Or said another way, what's the best way for an advisor to engage with the next generation?
The next generation is particularly driven by values, not valuables. And so I often encourage advisors to start with a conversation about values, not assuming that they're, you know, driven by that return, let's say.
And even that's got to be hard for people to do.
Especially if you're oriented and your performance has been measured by the returns yeah. you're bringing in. It is a pivot. I recognize that. And so to start on a more human level and to say, hi, tell me about yourself. What do you value? What do you care about? How do you, you know, next generation, Gen X, millennial, they often, Gen Z, we're starting to see, want to live seamlessly, aligning their values with the choices they're making. Whether it's about how they invest their money, right? We've seen that, you know, better than anyone, the increase in impact investing, sure. How they're making their grants in alignment with their values, not because there's quid pro quo with someone else in the community who's asked them for a grant, the places they volunteer, even the products they consume now, they're interested in the branding of the company, having yep. CSR or other kind of social impact, B Corps, et cetera. So for the advisors to think about their clients as being values driven, I think is a helpful place to start. Yeah. I know we build tools to help families and advisors have these kinds of conversations. And our most popular tool is our motivational values deck of cards, just a really simple deck, 30 values. And we say, you know, you can either give them to the client and tell them to do it. A lot of attorneys will say that our clients don't want to do a deck of cards if I'm going to charge them X amount an hour. So you can send it to them the night before they see you and they can sort their deck ahead of time. But really ask them to, what are your top three values? Prioritize the cards on the top of the deck, the values that most drive your decision making. And I think that will tell you a lot about who they are. And then you as an advisor can tell them your values. I also hear a lot of next gen saying, I want to be matched with an advisor who shares my values.
Yeah.
So we don't want to fake that or force that. Just be who you are. But having that values conversation, I think, will build a lot of trust.
No, that's great advice. I mean, we see that a lot. And we see that just, I mean, on one hand, I think advisors have done a great job of talking about values, but I don't think they've gone to the next level. It still tends to be values about retirement and those kind of things, and less probably a deck of cards and what are the true values.
In our research for our book, Generation Impact, How Next Gen Donors Are Revolutionizing Giving, we found that the assumption because of previous generations is that in retirement, donors will retire into philanthropic leisure. Just like you're saying, the emphasis has been on some of these activities at the sunset of our clients' lives. And next gen are starting these conversations much earlier. Mm-hmm. They see that they have discretionary resources and the challenges of the world are great. So why wait? Let's do this now.
Well, it's interesting. I had a conversation with a large asset manager probably a week ago. And essentially the question was about impact investing. Is it a fad? Is it a trend? And then what happens when the economy is a downturn? Does everybody say, oh, this doesn't matter anymore? Look, I don't have a crystal ball, but I actually think it's the exact opposite.
I agree.
And I think you just look at COVID and the social unrest and the political unrest, and I've watched more and more people going, I want to be part of the solution. So it's kind of counter to, I think, what some people are thinking.
I agree. We just did a survey. My co-researcher, Michael Moody, who holds the first endowed chair of family philanthropy in the country at Grand Valley State University, we fielded a survey of next gen donors last year, no, 2020 now. Mm-hmm. In the summer of 2020 to hear how next gen donors were responding to the crises. And how are they allocating their capital? And we really focused on grant making and philanthropy, of course, which they said 41% of the people we interviewed said that they're also thinking about their non-philanthropic capital, just their discretionary dollars. Yeah. And they're trying to spend them on local organizations, on BIPOC-led companies, not buying things off of multinational conglomerates, really looking for transparent companies to understand the values that those companies are aligning with, given the social issues of the day. So I just want to echo what you're saying, that next gen in particular are moving in values-driven ways even more than before.
And to me, one of the premises behind why I feel called to do what I'm doing is I know where your capital is or where your treasure is that your heart will follow. And so take an inventory of where somebody, where they save their money, how they spend their money, how they give their money, and how they invest their money actually gives a real indication. And I don't mean a judgmental thing of what they value. And I, what I hear you saying is NextGen is trying to say, I really want to be congruent across as many of those as I can with my values.
I think it used to be I'll make money on one hand and I'll then give it responsibly on the other.
Yep.
And now there's not that kind of compartmentalization that it is, there is alignment.
You use the word donor, and I know why you use it, why you use the word donor. I think, should there be a different term than donor? Because when I hear the word donor, all I think about is somebody who's giving stuff away.
Hmm. And you're saying as opposed to?
Well, if you think of the next gen as a whole person, and if they think about aligning their capital across, saying that they're just donors is in one sense could be limiting because they view the world so much bigger than that. And the reason why I say it is that I can hear, because of the language that I'm in, when I hear donor, I automatically think about their giving and they don't care about the investing side. But the truth is that donor is also an investor. So I just wonder if there's ever a terminology that will capture that a little bit better so that we don't compartmentalize those terms.
I appreciate the question, which is why we titled our book Generation Impact.
Yeah.
So in a way we could substitute that phrase, you know, Generation Impact, capital G, capital I, are using all kinds of tools in their toolbox, all their capital to allocate their resources for investing, for giving, for consumer purchases. Yeah. We even expanded the age-old maxim of time, talent, treasure to add ties because I think they see their
I noticed that
their networks as resources to allocate to. And I spoke to an ex-gen donor yesterday who said she's using her voice and her name recognition to leverage change as well.
Yeah, fascinating. I want to learn a little bit more about you. And you may have already answered this question, but how would you describe yourself in the context of where you are at in your life journey? Just a small one.
Well, I appreciate the time for self-reflection. I'm definitely in a stage, I'm 47, just to be transparent, where I'm asking my parents to be explicit about their values and their legacy and communicating that not just to me, but to writing it down, capturing it for future generations. I gave my mom the gift of Storyworth for her 70th birthday this past year.
Okay.
Which poses a weekly question via email that she can write a response to. They collect those over the course of the year and they put it together in a book so that you have that forever.
That is cool.
Even though I know how my mom would answer some of those questions, I thought my children will have them as well. And the next step, my dad is actually a decade older. He's 81 now. And so I'm encouraging him to do a video oral history. So that on the one hand, I'm raising children who are 13 and 10 and becoming the people who they are in the world. And so just trying really consciously to instill good values in them. My husband and I embarked on a charitable endeavor with them this year that every Friday night at dinner, we talk about the issues in our world and we research and decide one nonprofit that we're going to make a small family charitable contribution to every week. So we set aside the resources to do that, but are trying to engage our kids in the conversation. And, you know, a small gift may be a drop in the bucket to some nonprofits, but I think the bigger purpose of flexing our kids' muscles and thinking out loud with them about how we approach charity and make these decisions is really the bigger goal there. So where am I in life? I am honoring my parents and raising my children.
I tell you what, that's an awesome answer. And I don't normally say that to people, but I appreciate that. And I would say, fascinating, I was in a discussion with somebody recently, because I have a deep passion for those men and women who have been incarcerated and are now out. And so I've been investing in some businesses along those lines, specific to help provide jobs and a career. I just had somebody the other day, and I don't know that I have the answer, but they said, okay, so if you were to try to solve the criminal justice system, which is it's a huge thing, what's the root cause? All I can tell you is I've been going into prisons for in and out as a guest for the last 30 years. That there's two themes I see. One is a father who's typically absent, and then drugs. But so my answer to him was, I said, it's kind of a cliche answer, but I think it's true. And just listening to you give me that answer, I don't know if I'm right, but it's affirmative of that. And I basically said, the family unit. I mean, the fact that you sit down every Friday night and have these discussions with your kids, what a gift. Whether the amount you're giving away is $10 or whether the amount you're giving away is millions of dollars, to be trained around that, to have empathy for others. And by the way, when I say family, I can expand that to be broader than what we maybe think is a traditional family. But having adults who pour into you and train and teach and connect what happened with you, you know, the generation in front of you, and thinking about legacy, like, those are just really big deals. So anyways, just as you were giving that answer, I couldn't help but think, what an amazing gift that window of time is that you're providing for your kids. I know you know that.
Thank you. If I could also hold up a mirror and reflect back something I'm hearing from you, you know, we've learned the significance of being out in the field. You know, when we did this research of Gen X and millennials who give, I'm thinking about Victoria Rogers in particular, who talked about volunteering starting at the age of 12 with her father's encouragement. She lived in Chicago and on the north side, went to school on the south side and volunteered at the Sue Duncan Children's Center teaching art after school. And she said, not only did it help me find my passion and connection to the world of art, the volunteerism really changed my life to one of service. And then I went back to the data and said, is this just Victoria Rogers being remarkable? And she is remarkable. The data also shows that 75% of the people we interviewed started to volunteer before the age of 15, 90% before the age of 21, 50% started giving before the age of 21. So I do think that, even as you're saying, going into the prisons and seeing what's really going on, being able to touch the work and maybe having a hands-on way of engaging with it is transformational.
I got to tell you a quick story, because it's actually, and again, this is not to bolster me, but in light of what you just said. So I went into a prison system, I'm guessing 6 years ago in the state of California. Met a young man by the name of Ping. In fact, I've had him on here. Had an interaction with him like anybody would have. It changed his life. Long story short, he contacts me through LinkedIn. And I, you know, series of events now. He's out. He's got a job. He's got a wonderful job. He bought his first house. He's engaged. And so my wife and I are actually flying Ping and his fiance down to spend the weekend with us.
Oh, wow.
Was my interaction beneficial to him? Yes. Was the interaction beneficial for me? Heck yeah. That one little 4-hour window 6 years ago in a prison in California ends up, we're going to be with he and his fiance for 2 days in Orlando, Florida.
Amazing.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
How then would you describe what you're doing? And it could be whether you're doing at work or whether you're doing, you know, what you just described with your family. How are you trying to change the world?
You know, right now, 1% of the country owns 43% of the wealth. The wealth gap is pretty intense, and we're amid the largest wealth transfer ever, $59 trillion being transferred to the next generation, and about half of that is said to be going philanthropically, let alone the impact investing that's possible with those resources. And so my work at 2164, this organization I helped found, a nonprofit consulting company, is really about helping next gen and multi-generational philanthropic families to move their resources for social change. Mm-hmm. I feel really grateful to have found my purpose in my work.
Mm-hmm.
Just being able to help people again, going back to the beginning of our conversation, not be paralyzed by possibilities, but instead find their philanthropic identity, what they value, what their vision for the world is, and how they can allocate their resources in alignment with that. And I think those contributions can and will be important for our culture, our climate, our education, our communities for years to come.
When did you realize the power of capital, whatever that means to you? And then what does stewardship mean to you?
When I learned at a young age that some people live off of a dollar a day, you know, I appreciated what my father always said to me about, you know, the value of a dollar, that capital can be with a big C or a little C. You know, it's appreciating what it means to have the resources to feed ourselves, clothe our children, get an education, have opportunities in the world. And that started for me at a pretty young age, maybe at that moment where I made that first gift incurred by my parents matching.
Yeah.
But I've tried to take that responsibility seriously in my life. And stewardship, I define stewardship as caring for resources that came before me and will last after me. Honestly, I picture the redwoods. I picture trees that have roots in the ground and growing rings and up to the sky that have lived here many years before me and will be here many years after. And I'm just a steward in the circle of life.
I love that analogy, because if I were to choose to move anywhere, I'd go to Northern California. I grew up in the state of Oregon, so I love the mountains. I love the trees, but I also love seeing the sun. You see the sun more in Northern California than you do in Oregon. So it's a really great analogy. In fact, one of the analogies I give to people as I've gone into prison systems is you'll find what I call oak trees in prison. Men and women who their roots are deep and they're free. They're freer than most people outside the walls. And I call them oak trees. If you could make a dream come true for your life, what would that be?
Health and peace of mind for myself and my children and really all the children around the world.
I love it. We appreciate your insights and your knowledge. And thanks for your vulnerability and sharing with us. We'll definitely make sure that people know where to find your book and your research. I think it's critical, not only from, as we talked earlier, from a donor perspective, but just from a values and understanding how to align people's capital with their values. So thanks again for joining.
The newest edition of the book actually has best practice guides for professional advisors and nonprofit professionals, as well as families. So if any of those tips are helpful, thanks for checking it out.
And I'm assuming like those cards that you mentioned, is that something on your website as well that people can find?
2164.net. Thanks for asking.
Don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. And please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. I'm Jeff Schaefer. Until next time. This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.